Hi, my name is Jay, and I'd like to welcome you to another episode of Standardize, where we investigate how standards affect everyone's lives. This episode features Melina McPheeters, the chair of the ASME BPE standard, and a chemical engineer who works as the president of Refined Sciences Incorporated. Let's have a listen.
I'm Melina McPheeters. I'm the chair of the ASME Bioprocess Equipment Standard, and I worked in the bioprocess industry for more than 25 years. I'm a chemical engineer, and currently I work as the president of Refined Sciences Incorporated, who is a single-use technologies company.
Can you start by explaining what the ASME-BP actually stands for?
Yes, so ASME is the American Society for Mechanical Engineering, and BPE stands for Bioprocess Equipment. So the ASME BPE committee writes a standard called ASME Bioprocessing Equipment, which basically deals with the requirements for the design, construction, materials, and testing of components, equipment, and systems that are used in bioprocessing. And it's a little different to other ASME standards that people may be familiar with, because the BPE is industry specific, so it's just focused on one industry, which is bioprocessing, but it's not technology specific. So that means that we can deal with things that could be from maybe a temperature sensor to a bioreactor skid, so completely different things, but all towards the same kind of applications, while in other codes or standards, they may be more of technology-specific pressure vessels, so they may not be dealing with piping. There's a separate standard for piping, so it's more of a technology-specific rather than industry-specific. The ASME-BP committee is composed by 10 subcommittees, and then they all report into what we call the standards committee, which is oversees all of these subcommittees. We're about 300 voting members. My responsibility is providing the leadership for that standards committee. Most important is just providing guidance on what direction we're going, creating a structure for a strategic vision and a plan, and making sure that the publication occurs when it needs to occur.
How does it feel to be the first woman to serve as chairperson of the committee?
Yeah, so I never see it from that perspective, but it does become evident every now and then. I think it's important in a sense that when other members come to the meetings, that they feel that they see someone that may look more like them that is running the meeting. So I think it brings more confidence. If you're a young female engineer, maybe you're a little bit more scared to even, you know, give an opinion, just to see that, oh no, there's an opportunity for everybody. There's not going to be a prejudice because you don't look like the majority, let's say. So we've actually been working hard, being more inclusive and bringing more women into our organization.
What motivates you to participate in these ASME BPE events?
I started like more than 20 years ago and was invited by somebody who was already participating. And the main thing was just like all the requirements that eventually go into the industry on how to make this equipment, they start as a discussion at this BPE meeting. So it was part of interest from, you know, my employer that we needed to be, you know, aware of what was coming. Got more and more involved. As soon as I saw a way that I was contributing to something, I never left.
Why did you choose to dedicate your expertise specifically to this committee?
It's two sides. One side is when I first joined, there were discussing things that I have expertise on, so I felt that I can contribute. Also, I felt that there's a lot to contribute just by being able to be more strategic minded or a better project manager, to drive consensus. And sometimes, even if you're not the subject matter experts, but you have that ability, then you are contributing. And on the other side, because this is a great place to learn, so you're talking to industry experts. So we have, you know, like I said, close to 300 of them. If there's something you don't know, you're going to find somebody there that you can ask. You learn a lot just by participating.
What is the core mission or objective of the BPE standard?
So our vision is become like a globally accepted standard for the requirements about the manufacturing of components, equipment, and systems in bioprocessing. So we want to be a global standard, and our goal is that it will be the most recognized, and that we're writing this requirement so that there is equipment out there that when it's used in bioprocessing facilities, then they decrease the risk of contamination to the process, to the drug product, therefore provides more safety to the patient that is using those medications. It is recognized globally, but we do have more participation from the U.S. We have an important participation from Canada. We have quite a few European members and also members from Japan and China, and one member from Brazil.
And so how does the standard impact both businesses and end users?
It impacts them greatly for the manufacturers. The idea is that you want to conform to the requirements in the book, and the reason being because your customers are likely going to specify those requirements once they are in the standard. It's a huge impact. I mean, it could be things that change on the requirements that you may have to revamp the way that you do things. It's going to raise the bar on some of the procedures that you use and how you demonstrate this. We even have a certification program that goes even into your quality systems. And then on the end user side, this is to provide a benefit that then they have something that is more standardized. Each one of these companies, they don't need to reinvent the wheel when it comes to specifications of equipment. They can just all share their knowledge of what they need, and we can, you know, write the proper requirements that are going to meet their applications rather than everybody writing their own thing, which is also bad news for the manufacturers because now they have 10 people telling them to do 10 different things. We can all benefit of using what's in the standard or referencing the standard.
Does ASME-BP address only hygienic aspects, or does it cover broader considerations in biopharmaceutical manufacturing?
So that scope has changed through the years. While it's primarily about hygienic, it's not anymore only about cleanability and sterility. One of the main reasons is that there's much more than just that that goes into building components, equipment, and systems, so that has expanded. And with single use, well, that it doesn't even apply. But we still have some needs of keeping process integrity. So basically the scope is around how do we keep process integrity so we don't contaminate the process, or whatever requirements we can have to equipment to mitigate that risk. That's what we want to deal with in the standard.
Can you walk us through the process of developing a new ASME-BP standard release?
We publish every 2 years, and it's an ongoing effort. So there's two types of content that gets developed. Some is revisions, and some is new content. So the revisions is basically there's a paragraph already in the standard, and something has changed, or is now harmonized maybe with a different terminology or some rules, let's say maybe from the FDA or like in the CFRs, or, you know, has changed and we have to, or the USP, and then we need to kind of harmonize that. Or it could just be a restructure so that it's more readable. And it's also then there's a brand new technology we want to incorporate into the book. And that typically takes longer time and more effort. All of these things are handled through task groups. Those task groups are basically 4 to 6 people that have conference calls through the years. They write a proposal. That proposal gets presented to a subcommittee. Subcommittee has to vote and approve, and there's usually iterations on that. People don't always agree the first time. And then once it's approved, goes to this other committee that oversees everything called the Standards Committee. And they also have to agree, and there may be iterations. And then finally, the Board of Pressure Technology at the ASME level gives the last blessing. And then that's when it's ready to go into the next publication.
What kind of inputs does the committee consider when developing a new version of the standard?
So we have now more of a strategic vision on how we approach that and how we prioritize the content. One of the things is just if there are changes in any other standard that we are referencing, that would be one. So there are some that are continuing into that. So harmonization is a big thing. And the other one is just making a gap assessment. So the gap assessment is for different things. One is content that is in the book that has not been revised for many years and perhaps is now a little not obsoleted, but is not up to speed. And second, when we have new technologies that need to be brought in. So we need to also reach out, and we do this, we reach out to different organizations that with liaisons that give us a little bit of the voice of customers. So that gap assessment is also like, what is the industry telling us that they're having problems with? So we go to people like BioForum or BPSA. So there are different organizations that may have either is manufacturers or end users, and then they can tell us where they're lacking more requirements or where they're seeing problems in their processes that we'll be able to address. So one example at the BPSA, which is the Bioprocess Alliance, is a group of single-use manufacturers and end users, so users of single-use. There was a presentation about what are the top quality issues with single-use systems, when the number one, top one was particulate and how to interpret the level of particulate that is in an assembly. So that is actually something very actionable for us to work on.
Typically, how long does it take to publish a new edition?
So we do it every 2 years, but that is not the same time that it takes to develop a section. So a section can take many years to develop before it's ready for publication. So again, it depends. If it's a revision, probably doesn't take that long, so falls in between that publication cycle of 2 years. If it's a brand new section, then it may take more than that. So it may take more than one publication cycle to get that material approved.
And so who ultimately determines what goes into the standard?
It's the process of approval. So it starts at the subcommittee levels. The subcommittees also approve the task groups that they're forming. So it's not like just anyone can come and then throw something on the table and want it approved. So we start with like, okay, what's your scope? And if that makes sense, that it should be included into the book, then that becomes a proposal. And then it goes through that approval process that I was explaining earlier.
And what guiding principles or foundations are the standards based on?
So I guess they're different. They're on the technical, and then it's also on the just the procedural. So we're an ANSI accredited standard. So there are a number of things that we need to meet to be an ANSI accredited standard, which means it's like that we have participation of all groups of interest, that we have procedures for how we approve things, how we vote, how things get approved, make sure that all comments or disapprovals are addressed. We have a public review cycle as well once the publication is ready. So that is all, you know, requirements that come from ANSI, just to make sure that it's not biased, right? In that we're not trying to perhaps push a technology over the other, in that there is equal representation from the groups of interest. Now, from the technical side, that we actually interact quite a lot with, you know, other standards that are out there and guidelines. So all of these industry groups or trade organizations down from ISPE and BioForum, BPSA, PDA, they all write guidelines where we can distill some of the information on, you know, on the hot topics in the industry that eventually become requirements. And then we also have on the other side other ASME and ASTM standards that we use as a base. We try not to repeat what others have already written on the standard.
And so what typically drives updates to the standard?
Basically, it's that voice of customer, right? When we have a feedback or it's a concern, it's not working, the solutions that we have are not good enough. And that comes a lot from that liaison with these other groups, and not just only from the people that come to the meetings. And then we go to a prioritization. I mean, there could be many things, right? But we need to put some logic into what should we address first, depending on how big that need is.
And how much influence do other standard development organizations have on ASME BPE revisions?
Yeah, they do. We have actually a very good slide about what we call the alphabet soup. So how all of these groups connect with each other. So number one, the biggest influence is what the regulators are saying. So if the FDA changes anything that would change what we're saying, then we have to do something. That or the USP, the US Pharmacopeia. So they are the law. The end users need to conform or comply to them by law. It's not their choice. The good manufacturing practices come from there, but tend to be very general. They tell you what you have to do as a drug manufacturer, but they don't tell you how. So this is for equipment standards like ASME BPE or ASTM E55 is another one, come into play. So we can say more about the how by having a list of requirements. Okay, you're going to achieve what the FDA is telling you, you follow these requirements, or we're more likely to. Then from there, it's really a much bigger, you know, the base of that ladder is a lot of these organizations that basically, that's what I would call more like the voice of customer, like BioForum, which is a group of all end users, or BPSA, or even ISPE, so they can have a broader base of people that share their pains and frustrations and what things are not good enough requirements, perhaps, to be able to satisfy the regulators. We interact with a lot of other organizations that way.
Do differing opinions often arise during the standards development process?
Yes. That's what building consensus is, a skill. And it's a very necessary skill in these kind of organizations. First, because we're from different groups of interest. Second, because we're all different. And then third, it seems like voluntary organizations, we see that happening more often. It's like, well, I'm volunteering and I deserve my opinion. And in most cases, it's just that we're interpreting things differently. And sometimes that's where the need for definitions come into place. Let's all talk about the same thing. And sometimes, like 90% of the problems are resolved by, like, we were not talking about the same thing. And once we are, then, oh, well, then now we all agree. Not always. Sometimes there's a 10% that doesn't happen. But that's why we have a voting system. So there is a number of disapprovals that we can have and still be able to approve it. So it's a 2/3 approval rate. That's what we're looking at the end. So one example is we had a controversy on single-use valves. So if I can explain what a pinch valve is. So it's basically you have a piece of tubing and there is a mechanism that pinches that tube and closes it and opens it. Very common in single-use technologies. So we wanted to have a section on that, and many members at the standards committee level that are not familiar with single-use disapproved that it was outside of the scope of the standard because the mechanism to pinch that tube is not in contact with the process. The tube is. The difference is that the tube is provided by somebody, which is not the same company that provides the mechanism to pinch it. The misinterpretation was that for that to be a valve, it needs both. So if we just call the pinching mechanism a valve, then okay, there was an argument that could be made that perhaps it's out of the scope, but that's not a valve because it's not controlling flow. With the tubing, it becomes a valve. It really doesn't. I don't care that the tubing comes from another source. It doesn't work as a valve until you have the two things together. And so once we all kind of understood that, then we were able to approve that content. If somebody has a comment that is legitimate, and by changing, we're going to improve the proposal, then we usually do that.
How many people approximately are involved in developing the BPE standard?
So we have 292 voting seats, so that's membership. But we have many other people that help in the smaller groups and the task groups that sometimes they're not official members, but they may just join because we're talking on something that they're subject matter experts. And so that group could be anywhere like probably some 200 more people.
What kind of time commitment is required from participants?
At a minimum, you want to come to the meeting, so that's almost a whole week. So they start on Monday, they go through Thursday, they're three times a year. If you come to the meetings, you're likely gonna get involved into some action, you know, into one of these task groups. And those meet through the years, and there may be a conference call 1 hour once a month. It depends if you get involved in 10 of those. Yeah, then it's gonna be a lot of hours, right? But if you're just involved in the one, that's basically what you're looking at. But as you get more involved, you may become a member in more than one subcommittee. It's all volunteer work. So nobody gets paid to be here. But typically people are sponsored by their employers.
What role does the ASME itself play in supporting the BPE committee?
So ASME provides all the infrastructure, basically. So the platform that we use for voting, the staff secretary, the interaction with all the publication structure, you know, editors and whatever, publishing the book, and even organizing the meetings and booking the hotels and paying, you know, for the conference rooms and et cetera. So, yeah, we rely a lot on ASMEs.
How do you see your leadership as the first woman chairperson and the BPE standard itself shaping society and the industry?
That's an interesting big question. When I decided to run for chair, it's like I don't like reinventing the wheel, having to rehash something that was discussed three meetings before, and that happens, right? And realize there was a lot of tribal knowledge that was in the head of people that were here, but you were never told. So you were like a young person here, and you would volunteer to one of those task groups, and you write your proposal, they would shred it to pieces because you didn't know all of these 20 hidden rules that were out there, or were even fine, you know, references to how you were supposed to do it. Well, the main objective is like, can we just bring some common sense to this? Why don't we write that stuff? First thing is, let's start a strategic plan. Are we all kind of driving in the same direction? Why do we have arguments about what our scope is? How could we even disagree on that? We have some five main objectives that now we're keeping track. We have a strat plan that was approved, actually. We have a vision and a mission. So I've worked on, you know, running companies my life, been in three startups, and bring some of that management skills to the group. The interesting thing about women in this group that we're still only like 10% of the voting members, but it's a much higher level of those that are in the membership positions. It's easy to see that some of the female talent that we get here, they actually want to go the full way, much, you know, strong commitment and participate in the leadership as chairs or vice chairs or whatever of subcommittees and lead task groups.
And so what advice would you offer to women in engineering who aspire to leadership roles like yours?
Not to be afraid to say what you think. When we get young female engineers at BPE, they have more of a tendency to be absolutely sure beyond any doubt that what they're going to say is correct. And sometimes we see some of our male counterparts that are, they just say whatever they they can come and think of without even filtering that. And it's just like, I'm not saying one way is better than the other, but sometimes people are a little afraid to speak out, and they shouldn't be afraid to speak out. So that's the first one. Raise your hand. Nobody's going to ask something stupid. And if you do so, so what? Then once you get that and you're able to say something, and you don't necessarily need to make a statement. You can just ask a question. But let your voice be heard. And then find people that can mentor you.
How do you view this work in the context of volunteerism and service to society?
It's interesting because there are two reasons to, you know, volunteer. One is because, well, you have a business interest in what is being discussed. But there's also something beyond that, that is what actually brings value to society, is that you become an expert on something. And sometimes the way that you do things at your company, or if you're a drug manufacturer, as a drug manufacturer at that facility, is not necessarily the best way to do it. So when we get volunteers here that have that view, can we bring best practices, not defend what I do so I don't have to change anything? That's when we can advance the industry.